efficient quantum algorithm for approximating the Tucker polynomial and the partition function of the Q-state box model. And this is a joint work with Dorit Aharonov, Elad Devan, and their partner. So if we look about on the quantum algorithm that give an exponential speedup over classical algorithms, we can roughly divide them into three main groups. The first and the biggest group is the short time algorithms that are based on the quantum Fourier transform, and they can all be more or less casted as a hidden subgroup problem. And in these algorithms, we have the first short algorithm factoring, and then we have group order, the Gendre symbol, etc., and all these algorithms that are listed here. The second interesting group of algorithms that give also an exponential speedup are the algorithms that are based on quantum random walks, and this is a fairly recent result. And the third group in which I'm going to focus is the group to which belongs the AGL algorithm, which is an algorithm that approximates the Jones polynomial. Now, the Jones polynomial is a function, is a polynomial that we can define for knots, which are just take a rope and you tie it, and this defines a knot. And the special thing about the Jones polynomial is that it is a knot invariant. If we change the knot a little bit, as long as we don't tear it, we will always calculate the same function for it. So it is an invariant knot, and it was discovered by Jones in the mid-80s, and ever since it found its way to many numerous physical fields and mathematical fields like topological field theory, statistical physics, also biology, and many other fields in science. And using its connection to topological field theory, and also using the connection between topological field theory and topological quantum computation, then Kitai, Friedman, Lasker, and Wang found that there exists an efficient quantum algorithm that could approximate this function for knots. And I should add, calculating this or even approximating this function classically, as far as we know, is exponentially difficult. Using the connection between topological field theory and topological quantum computation, these guys found that there is an efficient quantum algorithm to approximate this quantity, and this algorithm was casted in the framework of topological quantum computation. And knowing that there is such an algorithm, and using basically knowing that. Because topological quantum computation is equivalent to standard quantum computation, then recently, like 2 years ago, Aharonov, Jones, and Andal came up with an explicit quantum algorithm that approximates this quantity, and we call it. By the way, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to stop me. Okay. And we call it the AGL algorithm after the authors. And what is special about this algorithm, comparing especially to the first group of algorithms that I mentioned before, is that first of all, it is an algorithm that gives you an exponential speedup over a classical algorithm, but it is not based on the quantum Fourier transform. Instead, what it does is it uses some sort of a mapping that maps the combinatorial structure of the problem into an algebra, and then it maps the algebra into matrices using some sort of a unitary representation, and then these matrices are applied on a quantum computer, and we get the result that we are trying to find. Another important point is that this algorithm provides an additive approximation of the Jones polynomial instead of multiplicative approximation, and I will elaborate on that point later. And finally, the algorithm solves a problem which is BQP hard. Therefore, we have a BQP complete or quantum complete problem here, which is the first, I think, non-trivial in that sense. So these points are special for this class of algorithm. And what I'm going to present here now is a sort of a generalization of this algorithm, or in some sense this approach. What I'm going to show that there is an efficient algorithm that gives an approximation for the Tuple enumel, and the Tuple enumel is a polynomial that I will soon define. It can be defined for any graph. And for many points, this approximation is BKP hard. So and as a result, we have a new family of many BKP complete problems. And the improvements and the contributions of this work with regard to the previous work of Arnold, Jones, and Landau is that, first of all, we're breaking the unitary barrier. Unlike the AGL algorithm, which only used a unitary representation of the algebra, we are now going to use non-unitary representation. And this thing will be used both in the algorithmic part and in the universality part. So we're going to show how we can prove quantum universality using non-unitary operators. And the other thing is that this result also provides an algorithm to approximate the partition function of the POTS model, which is the Q-state POTS model, which is a famous model in statistical physics. And although I will come to it later, it does not solve this problem completely, but it does pose some sort of a progress on that front. Okay, so the other one of my talk will be, I will first give a short background on the Tuple enumel. I will then present the quantum algorithm, and then I will sketch somewhat roughly the proof of the universality, and I will give a summary and conclusion in the end. So, what is the Tuple enumel? What I'm going to present here is actually called the multivariate Tuple enumel. And this is a polynomial that we can define for any graph like this graph, which has weights attached to its edges, okay? And the Tuple polynomial is a polynomial in these weights, which we denote by V, and in an additional complex number, which we denote by Q, okay? And the idea is that in order to calculate it, we have to look at all the subgraphs of G. So for example, we have three subgraphs here. Subgraph is just when we choose a subset of the edges, okay? And for each subgraph, what we're going to do, we're going to take all the weights that are assigned to the edges that remain in this subgraph, and we're going to multiply them. And in addition, we're going to multiply everything with a factor of q times the number of connected components in the graph. So for example, here we have only one connected component, so it's only q to the power of 1. Here we have two connected components, so it's q to the q squared. And here we have three, so it's q to the power of 3. So this way, every subgraph gives us a contribution, and when we sum over all these exponential sums, we obtain this multivariate polynomial. Okay, and this is the function that we are interested in. And why are we interested in it? Well, first of all, it encodes many, many important properties of the graph on which it is calculated. For example, it encodes the reliability of the network. The number of spanning trees this graph has. It encodes also it specializes also for the chromatic polynomial of the graph, the polynomial that counts how many colorings this graph has for different hues. And also it specializes for the Jones polynomial using some sort of a connection between planar graphs and links, which I will show in the next slide. And
could I ask a question here, as you mentioned it? The algorithm for approximating the POTS model partition function, will that be for planar interaction graphs?
Yeah.
Only?
Yeah, only for planar graphs.
But this polynomial is defined for all graphs.
Yes, that polynomial is defined for every graph, but I'm gonna prove my results only for planar graphs. Also, if we take integer q's and we take weights that are larger than -1, real weights, then this function, Z of G, is exactly the partition function of the Q-state POTS model. So if we know how to approximate it, we basically know how to approximate the partition function of the Q-state POTS model. And finally, this is a generalization of a polynomial which is better known as the standard path polynomial, which is a polynomial in two variables, X and Y. And there is a very simple connection between this polynomial and this polynomial. When we take all these weights to be the same weight, okay, then this is a function of two variables, Q and V, and it is easily related to X and Y. There is a very simple connection between them. So in some sense, this is a generalization of the standard time polynomial. So this is the time polynomial, and now the question is how hard is it to calculate it? So if you want, and these are the results for the standard time polynomial. If you want to evaluate exactly, then a result by Jagger from 1990 says that it is sharply to calculate even at one point for almost all points in the xy plane, except for some few trivial points and a few trivial trajectories on the plane. So exact evaluation is probably out of reach. So what about multiplicative approximations, also known as F-thrust? So we know that for special case of Q equal 2 with positive weights, which stands for the ferromagnetic isomotor, then there is a polynomial random algorithm that gives a multiplicative approximation, and this is a result of Jerome and Sinclair from 1993. But on the other hand, a very recent result by Goldberg and Jerome says that for roughly 3/4 of the xy plane, it is NP-hard to give a multiplicative approximation of this function, and the remaining of the plane, the remaining quarter, which includes also the ferromagnetic Boltzmann model other than the Ising model, the complexity is still an open question and is still unknown. Yes.
Can you remind me what are these pairs x y?
The pair x y. The pair are the variables of the standard Hart polynomial. And I said that the standard Hart polynomial is a special case of the multivariate polynomial that we get when all the weights are the same. Then this function is basically a function only of two variables, Q and V. Okay, so and it is very simply related to X and Y. So basically these two polynomials are completely equivalent. Okay, so and because it is the standard Hart polynomial is somewhat more famous, so most of these results are written for this function instead of the multivariate polynomial. That's why I'm using it. So now this begs the question whether quantum computation can do any better. And my answer is yes, it can. But in order for this to be true, we have to somewhat loosen a bit the notion of approximation. What is actually approximation? And this is kind of a tricky thing here. Suppose we want to approximate a function f of x. Okay, so basically, if we have a multiplicative approximation, it means that we can find a y in some polynomial time that is bounded between f of x times 1 minus epsilon and f of x times 1 plus epsilon, where epsilon is a very small quantity that scales as 1 over a polynomial, okay, and the order of the problem. On the other hand, what I'm going to use here and I'm going to introduce is additive approximation. And an additive approximation, when I say it, I mean that I will find an algorithm that will give me a number y between these two bounds, between f of x minus epsilon times some delta of x, and f of x times epsilon times plus epsilon times delta of x, where delta of x is another scale of the problem. It's a quantity that I will know how to calculate. It's a simple quantity that I will know how to calculate for any input x. But the problem is, of course, that if this quantity is much, much larger than f of x, then this thing here is can be meaningless, can be trivial. So this is a very tricky thing, and I will have to address this issue. So bear it in mind. But basically what this thing says, that says given delta of x, I can always narrow down this window using one over poly of n. Okay. So because of this epsilon factor. Okay, so using this notion of additive approximation, a rough version of the result that I'm about to present is that there is an efficient quantum algorithm that provides an additive approximation for the multivariate Hart polynomial. And so this is what it does. And this is true for any planar graph with any set of weights and any complex number q. And the set of weights are also supposed to be complex. Okay. And finally, the approximation scale, which I didn't give here, but I will give later, is a number that depends on G, it depends on Q and V, and also on the way that in which we embed G on the plane. Remember, G is a planar graph. Okay, so this is the main result. And the way this algorithm works, I will give now a very rough sketch of how it works. What we will do, we will start with a planar graph, which has weights, and we will transform it into another graph, which we call the weighted medial graph, which can be seen as some sort of a projection of a link on a plane. And then we're going to embed this graph in an algebra of diagraphs like this. And we're going to present this graph in some sense as a product of elements in this algebra. And there will be a very simple connection between the product of these elements and the function that we are trying to approximate. And in order to find this product of elements, I'm going to use a representation of this algebra. I'm going to translate all these elements into matrices, and then I'm going to implement these matrices on a quantum computer and do this multiplication on a quantum computer and therefore obtain Z of G. Okay. So this is the overall structure of the proof. So now let's do it in details. So the first step is to build the so-called medial. So as I said, it can be seen as a projection of a link on a plane, and we define this medial graph LG for every planar graph G. And how we do it? The idea is that we draw G, and then what we do, we draw a crossing in the middle of every edge of G. And then we simply go along the edges of G and connect the adjacent crossing this way. So this procedure basically defines uniquely a medial graph for every planar graph and a planar graph for every medial graph. This is a one-to-one connection. And notice that the crossings here basically are transformed into, the edges here are transformed into crossing here. And what we also do, in addition, is that we drew this medial graph, we now can forget about the skeleton, this planar graph that came in the start. And what we can do, which will prove very helpful, we're going to paint it in white and blue. And we do that by first painting the external region by white, and then we proceed into other regions, and whenever we cross a line, we change the color. So also this kind of coloring, yes?
Over under crossings. Over and under crossings. I mean, when
no, there is no over and under. It's not like a Jones polynomial. There is no over and under crossing.
Okay.
It's fused.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
So in this particular example, the blue regions are all associated with the nodes of the graph.
Yeah, precisely.
Is that so? That's always true.
It's always true.
Okay.
So we have a graph which is four regular, and notice also that the weight, the edges in G which are weighted are transformed into crossings here, and we also will attach weights to this crossing. Every crossing will be attached a weight, and there will be a very simple connection between these weights here and these weights here, and I will give it shortly. Okay. Okay. So this is basically now the object that I'm going to work with, the medial graph. And so the next stage is to define the equivalent of the Taft polynomial, but on this new object, the medial graph. And we call this object the Kaufman bracket. And this is also a polynomial in the weights of the crossings, which we call u, and an additional parameter, which we call d. Okay? And the idea is that this is a polynomial which we define by opening all the crossings in the medial graph. Now, if we look on a crossing, this is a crossing with some weight here, then there are basically two ways we can open it up after we did the blue and white color. We can either open it up such way that the blue region are connected, or we can open it up such that the blue region are disconnected. Okay? So whenever we open up all the crossings in one or another way, we end up only with loops. So the Kaufman bracket is basically a sum over all these possible ways of opening up all the crossings. There are two to the power n possible ways. And for each such opening, what we do, we sum up the contribution, which is d to the time of number of loops that ended in this way. Because remember, we end only with loops after we open up all crossings. So it's d to the number of loops times all the weights for which we opened the crossing in such a way that the blue regions were connected. Okay. So for example, here, you see, we opened up these three crossings, this one and this one, in such a way that connected the blue regions, and we ended up with three loops, one, two, three. Okay, so the contribution from this opening will be exactly d to the three times u times all these three weights. Okay, whereas this way will not be included because we opened it in such a way that disjoints the blue areas. So now bear in mind that every crossing corresponded to basically to an edge in the original graph. So basically, these two ways of opening up a crossing actually corresponds to either we include this edge in a subgraph or we remove it from the subgraph. Okay? So it's not too difficult to see that this is exactly this is equivalent to the sum that defines a multivariate topolynomial. And indeed, there is a very simple connection that you can verify it yourself between the Kaufman bracket of the medial graph and the topolynomial of the original graph. And this is the connection. So basically, q goes to d squared, and every weight v goes to the weight d of u. So this is the connection between the weights of the medial graph and the weights of the planar graph. Okay, so this is now the function that I'm going to cross. Okay, any questions?
Which one is the function?
The Kaufman bracket. This. Yeah.
So, do you have any relations? I mean, do the Riedemeister moves? I suppose you are talking about invariance. So you have Riedemeister moves.
I'm not talking about invariance. This is not a link, and there is no this invariance.
Okay, that was what I was going to ask. So no constraints among the and u, completely independent.
Yeah, the Jones polynomial. Actually, you obtain a Jones polynomial if you pick a very specific value of d and the weights u, and then you obtain this invariance. But I'm talking on the more general case in which I don't have this, so there is no invariance. So the next step now is to embed this this medial graph in an algebra, and the algebra that I'm going to use is the generalized Temple-Lieb algebra, and basically it's an algebra that can be viewed as an algebra that is abstractly spanned by diagrams of this form. So in each diagram here, we basically have some n strands down below, and we have some m strands here. And n and m don't have to be the same. And we make sure that these strands never cross each other and that they don't contain any loops. Okay? So we look now at all these diagrams, and this way, a general element in the algebra is simply a superposition of all, or a linear combination of all these diagrams. Okay? And what is the product rule of this algebra? Well, the product rule is very simple. What we do is, in order to multiply two such basis elements, we just place one on top of the other. And if there are any loops that are created, we take them out as a d factor. Okay? D is a parameter that defines this algebra. It's an external parameter. Okay? So this is how we define multiplication. And well, there is some technical point here that we must have that the number of flow of bottom strands here correspond to the number of upper strands here. But if it doesn't, we can easily there is some technicality, but we can easily solve it. But anyway, in this talk, I'm going to concentrate only on diagrams for which the lower number of strands always match the upper number of strands.
Sorry. So the algebra can involve different numbers on the bottom, for instance, the number of trends on the bottom, could be a superposition.
Excuse me?
The algebra can be a superposition of things that have different numbers
on the bottom. Although basically in what will follow, it will turn out that it's always the same number in everything we do. But basically, yes, you're right. It can have different numbers. Okay. And finally, the identity element of this algebra is basically just straight lines. Because if we put straight lines on top of the diagram, we don't change it. So it's the identity element. Okay. So now the idea is that we can now define a map that takes this medial graph and somehow distorts it in such a way that at every height there will be only one minima or a maxima or a crossing. Okay? And we will now dissect it with horizontal lines in such a way that we get this diagram that if we put one on top of the other, we actually obtain this graph here. Okay, so this is the idea of how we map this graph into a product of elements of the algebra. But this is not done yet because if we have a minima and we have a maxima, then okay, minima and maxima, as I said before, are legitimate object of the algebra. Okay. But the problem is what we do with crossing such that. What do we map this thing here to which algebra elements? And the idea is that, again, what we want to calculate is the Kaufman bracket. Okay? So the idea is that whenever we encounter a crossing, we're going to translate it into a linear combination of the two possible diagrams that we obtained from opening up this crossing. So there are two possible ways. Either we are connecting the blue areas or disconnecting them. And we're going to give a weight u. Okay, remember, each crossing comes with a weight. So we're going to give a weight u to the diagram that corresponds to the way in which the blue regions are connected. Okay, and this way, whenever we have crossing, basically we have two elements. So, and it's not hard to see that basically this way we get all the possible opening of the diagram. Okay, so the product is basically a product that translates into a sum. And so the conclusion is that this mapping, okay, it basically maps the medial graph into an element of the algebra which is always proportional to the identity, because we don't have any, we have zero strands here and zero strands here, so basically this thing only corresponds to some scalar, okay? And the factor between the identity is exactly the Kaufman bracket that we are looking for. Is this understood? This is like an important point.
Can you please, Paris, explain? I guess that the whole knot will come out as some matrix element. So initial state, evolution, non-unitary, I suppose, final state. But could you please explain what these maxima and minima are, maybe what they translate into, or is this?
Well, they are simply the. I mean, all I'm talking about now is translating this into the algebra structure. Mm-hmm. So these guys are legitimate diagrams in the algebra. Okay, I mean,
nice. Okay. One. What is this? This called corollary box there.
So the corollary box says that this transformation, okay, that takes the medial graph and translates it into a product of elements in this algebra, basically what it does, it translates it into an element which is always proportional to the identity element of the algebra. Okay? Why is it the identity element? Because basically it is, I mean, okay, after we open up all this crossing, we are left with only loops. Okay? So there is zero strands downstairs and zero strands upstairs. So it's only a number, basically. Okay? So it's only proportional to the identity. So it's proportional to the identity, and the proportionality factor, this is the thing that we're interested in, is exactly the Kaufman bracket. Okay, so this is an important point. Okay. So now the idea of the algebra. Okay, so far this is what we've done. We had this Kaufman graph, we translated it into the medial graph, and we now presented it as a product of elements in this algebra. And the next step is now to use some sort of a representation that will represent every one of these algebra elements into a matrix. And what it will give us, we will use the property of the representation that the product of the matrices correspond basically to the matrix of the product of elements of the algebra. This is exactly what defines a representation. Okay? And since this is proportional to the identity times times the Kaufman bracket, and the identity of a representation always goes to the identity of the matrix. Okay? Identity always goes to identity. So we conclude that the product of these matrices will be proportional to the Kaufman bracket times the identity matrix. Okay? So so if we can calculate this matrix product, we will be able to calculate the Kaufman bracket. And the idea is now that to use a special representation of this algebra, which we call the path model representation. And first of all, what are the Hilbert spaces on which this representation works? And it does not work on a single Hilbert space. It works on a group of Hilbert spaces, which we call Hn. And these Hn are basically spanned by walks on a line. Okay, so imagine we have a line, this line here, and we number the nodes of the line starting from 1, 2, 3, etc. Okay? And now we look at, on walks on this line, we say 4 steps. So this is a possible walk on that line. So all walks on this line that start from the leftmost, or from the bottom, from the first node, and proceed, and they have four steps, are the basis vectors of H4. And so for Hn, I mean, we just look at walks with n steps. Okay. So these are the Hilbert spaces that we're going to work with. And now we look at the diagram, the basis element of this algebra. And the question is, okay, how does this diagram now translate into an operator that acts on these paths? And the idea is that we will now paint the regions of this diagram with nodes. I mean, we will assign to each one of these regions here a node from the line, for example, like this. And we will make sure that the leftmost region is always 1. Okay? And we will also make sure that whenever we, that neighboring regions will be labeled by vertices which are neighboring on this line. Okay? For example, like that. And now, when we look on the gaps on the bottom part of the diagram, then we see that we actually obtained a path. Okay? But if this diagram has n strands, that we obtain the path with n walks, with n steps. And of course, and similarly, if we look now at the upper gaps here, you also obtain a new graph, a new path. Okay? So in this example, this diagram, so what it gives us is sort of a transition between this path here, which belongs to H4 because it has 4 steps, into that path here, which has six steps. Okay. So and generally, any diagram which has n lower strands and n upper strands will be mapped into a linear transformation between Hn and Hn. Okay. So I haven't really defined it yet. Okay, the exact way this thing works, I'm not going to do it.
Maybe you can answer a question about it. So, for the loop in the upper right,
yeah,
why is that one 2 instead of 4?
Well, that's a good question. It can be also 4. Basically, a 4 is also a legitimate coloring that will give you the same path here and a different path here, and therefore, this path here will be transformed into a superposition of two possible paths that it can be mapped to.
Okay.
So there is a 4 here.
So
and what I didn't tell you is how I decide what the weights are. And okay. And this is, I mean,
and the bottom one, you could have a 1 in the middle then also?
Yeah, but then of course.
So
yeah. But then it would not be but then I mean you're walking on a different path, right?
Right, okay. So the idea is that you choose some possible path for the bottom.
Yeah. And then you do all, you look at all the coloring that, that are compatible with this path, and you look at all the other paths, the output paths that they produce. And so you have a linear combination. And the exact way in which I set the weights, I just don't have time to get into it. It has to do with the, with some properties of the light graph and looking at its eigenvalues and stuff like that, but I will not get into it. An important lesson here is that a diagram which has zero strands here and zero strands here will be simply will work on H on will be a transformation from H0 to H0. And H0 is just a one-dimensional Hilbert space that contains only this walk where you stay on the first with zero step when you stay on the first side. So it will be basically just a number, just a scalar that will multiply this vector with.
Actually a number or a polynomial in these variables? There's no u's or anything.
Polynomial in which variables? You mean in the weights you want to?
Yeah.
Well, I'm now regarding these weights as fixed. So for me, they are just numbers.
Okay.
So again, what we have here now is that we have a product of matrices that correspond to this GTL element, and this basically gives us the Kaufman brackets and the identity operator. And the idea of the algorithm now is that we start with this vector that spans H0, okay, the zero steps vector, and we will apply the first operator, okay, for example, this minima here. So we will now move into H2, okay, because we'll have two steps now. And we then will apply the crossing operator, and so on and so forth, until we get the last vector here. And because of what I said before, basically this is a diagram with zero input strands and zero output strands. So basically all this has to be, again, something which is proportional to this vector here. And we know, because of that, that the proportionality vector is kind of, proportionality factor is exactly LG. Okay. So this is what we obtain in the end. And in order to get this factor here, we need to take the inner product. And this is basically what we get. But now there are, of course, a few problems. And the main one is that in order to implement it on a quantum computer, we must make sure that these matrices are unitary. Okay? And so we have come up somehow with an idea of how to work with non-unitary matrices if we have one. Okay? Another thing that I forgot to mention, I didn't write it here, but another special property of this representation is that it preserves the local structure of the diagram. Okay? Because if we have, for example, let's see. If we have a diagram that has straight strands here, and okay, something is happening here, for example, and then made a straight strand here. Okay? So every path that we will write here will be transformed. This part of the path and that part of the path will always be transformed here to the same thing. Okay, because this is the only coloring that is allowed here because of these straight strands. So basically it means that only the middle part of the path will be changed. So in that sense, this representation preserves the local structure of the diagram. If we have something going on in the middle and only in the middle, then only the middle part of the path will be changed. Okay, so this is an important property of this representation, and that would enable us to implement it efficiently on a quantum computer. Is this clear?
Because there's no crossovers?
No, simply because remember that the way this vector, this path is determined is by coloring the different ridges. Okay, but if we have straight lines, then you have, for example, one here, then it means you paint this region in one. And then it means that this region also must be one. There is no other choice. So basically it means that the exact steps here will be exactly copied to here. So there will be no change on non-local places in the path. Okay, only on the places that correspond to some to places where there is no where it is not straight tracks. Okay, when there is a minimal, maximal, whatever.
Yeah. So let me just check that I have a sort of idea what this means, the locality. So I want to check if it's correct. So like you have a Hilbert space here of varying dimension, and I suppose you want to embed this Hilbert space and a larger Hilbert space with a tensor product structure.
Yeah, precisely.
And so you say these local operations like fusing two lines and so forth, that will then be represented by an operation on two neighboring qubits, and the rest is unaffected.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant by the property.
So you have one of these diagrams that you're mapping to the transformation on paths.
Yeah.
And so then you're going to multiply it with another sex diagram.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that not that for a given diagram, not all possible paths for that number of strands can be realized as one end of that diagram. Right? Like if so you go back slide, I guess. So like in that one, on the bottom, the second number and fourth number have to be the same.
What do you mean? So this, I mean, this and this?
The two, they had to be the same, right? Because they're the same region.
Yeah.
But in the diagram below it,
They
might not have had to be the same.
No, all it means that if you have a path where it is not the same, then this will go to zero.
Okay. So.
So it is a non-reversible operation.
Okay. So that means it can't be unitary in fact.
This particular diagram cannot be unitary. Yes.
Okay.
But I mean, for example, if you would have crossings, it's a linear combination of two diagrams. And it can be reversible, it can be unitary. That's how basically the Jones polynomial algorithm works. You have crossings. That's true, it cannot be. Okay, so now the question is how to implement these operators on a quantum computer. So let us start with the crossing. So remember, crossing is basically in the algebraic space. It's just a linear combination of two algebra elements, and this is transformed into a linear combination of two matrices. And these are square matrices because the number of strands here equals the number of strands there. Okay, so we have basically a square matrix that we want to implement, which does not have to be unitary and does not have to be reversible. And it is some transformation between Hn to Hn. Okay. So how do we implement it? And the idea is to use the polar decomposition. We can present any matrix as a product of a positive definite matrix and some unitary matrix U. This is the polar decomposition theorem. And if we want to implement it, then U is unitary and it's easy to implement because of this locality property. Okay, it's an important thing. And now we want to implement P, and again we can assume without loss of generality that this is diagonal and it has these non-negative eigenvalues, R1, R2, where R1 is the biggest one. So the idea is to implement P divided by its norm. Okay, so then it is this diagonal matrix where 1 is the biggest, is the largest eigenvalue, and then we have all these eigenvalues between 0 and 1. And we do that by adding an ancilla qubit to the system, basically. Okay, so it's not very surprising. And then we simply use this transformation, where if we have a zero, where the projection on zero on the ancilla qubits actually give us the right transformation. And the idea is that in the end we will project on this qubit. Yes.
You know, that seems to be a relevant point. Does it mean your algorithm is efficient conditioned on post-selection?
No. No.
Because, I mean, physically you cannot project, you need to measure.
I will measure, and I will count the number of times I get this result.
Yeah, well, but then it seems that I don't know what the relative ratio between obtaining this.
That's the source of the nature of the approximation. It will be an additive approximation.
Okay, but I mean, in principle, you are losing a factor of probability with every crossing.
Yeah. Not necessarily, but you basically can lose.
Maybe the better way to phrase it is you're post selecting in every crossing.
Okay. And remember that we divided by this norm of the projection operator, of the positive definite matrix, which is actually the norm of M of the crossing operator. So it means that we have to bookend these norms in the end. And multiply the overall result by this product of norms. So this is how we do the crossing operators. And now, for the minima and maxima operators, then it is relatively simple. A minima is an operation between hn to hn plus 2, and we obtain it by adding more qubits, two registers to the system, and using some other square matrix operation that we can implement using this technique. And in the same way, a maxima is just an operation that takes us from hn to hn minus 2, and we can do it simply by forgetting to register a few qubits. Okay.
But if we have two of those in a row,
so
obviously, you know, it's just a loop. We're supposed to get rid of that anyway, but we're supposed to get rid of it with a factor of g, right?
With a factor of d, why?
Or with a factor of whatever the factor of q.
Yeah, we implement some square matrix here, and this implementation takes care of all these factors.
So the idea is that at the end of the day, we're going to be keeping track of all of these overall kind of constants.
These ones, you mean? The norm.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that's something that you can easily calculate classically.
Yeah. Yes. Of course.
Okay.
So this brings me to the next slide. Again, let's look at what we did. We have this computation. We start from this vector 1 that corresponds to the initial vector here. We go up all the way, and what we get. We get basically now, in the end, this factor here. This is the Kaufman bracket divided by all the norms of the operators that we implemented along the way, okay? Because of this, of the previous slide. Remember, we had to bookkeep the norm, okay? Times 1 and all the ancilla qubits for which the ancilla qubit is 0, and then we have the remainder, okay? Which is places where the ancilla qubits are no longer zero. And so basically what we want to do is we want to approximate or evaluate the inner product of this state with that state here. Right? And we can do it simply using the Hadamard test, which is a standard technique. Is it known? I mean, the Hadamard test. Basically, it is equivalent to say to measuring this thing many times and counting how many times you get this result. 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. So the resolution of this kind of approximation, the resolution that you get is basically this factor. I mean, you will get these factors plus minus some 1/polyn. Polyn is the number of times more or less in which you make this measurement.
You can do quadratically better, probably, with quantum counting.
I don't know. Maybe. So this is basically.
Okay, so let me just verify. So what you this Hadamard test is nothing. So you produce that state in the way you have described, and then you measure all these registers, and you count the relative frequency of the cases where you have one.
Precisely. precisely. And the other method is just in order to get, I mean, I mean, if you do like this, you will only get the square, the amplitude of this, right? And the other method is just a nice way of taking the real and the imaginary part of this. Okay. So basically, this is the resolution that we're going to get, and this is exactly the reason why the overall result that we get is we get this this factor here times everything that is here down below. So the approximation scale, which is exactly this, is basically the product of all the norms of the operators that we use along the way. Okay. And as I said, this is a simple function to calculate, so we can calculate it easily. And therefore,
so that first qubit.
Yeah.
Is there any content in the fact that it's one, or is that forced by the fact?
It is forced. It is forced by it. You must end up with one.
But only when the ancilla qubits are all zero. So.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, I guess. Otherwise, it doesn't. Okay. So this is the idea of the algorithm. It's actually much simpler than the AGL algorithm, because I don't know if some of you know the AGL algorithm, but the AGL algorithm uses actually the concept of Markov properties and trace functions, and here we eliminated all these things. I mean, in my opinion, it is much simpler. Okay, so to summarize this first part, what we found is that there is an efficient algorithm that provides an additive approximation of the type polynomial, and this is true for any planar graph and with any set of weights. And for any complex number q. So, and finally, that the approximation scale is exactly the product of the norms of all these operators that we used along the way. So now, as we said before, this notion of additive approximation is very tricky. So are we getting a non-trivial approximation here? And to answer this, I will make sure that this approximation problem is actually BKP hard, and therefore it is not trivial. And this will be my way of showing that it is not trivial. And this result is actually also already known for the case of the Jones-Spahn model. I mean, we've done here is some sort of a generalization, but the Jones-Spahn model was only limited to the case where these representations are unitary. Okay, and this limitation limited the types of weights and cues that we can use. Okay, the requirement for unitarity. So, and what I'm going to show here is how to do it for the non-unitary case, or for some of the case. And what we will do, I will generalize the proof that we used in the work of Dewitt and myself, which also basically followed the work of Friedman, Kitai, Blass, and Wang, showing the universality of the Jones-Spahn monomial collision, and here we will just do it for the non-unitary case. And as far as we know, it's the first time where universality is proved using non-unitary operators. Okay, so this is the dark side of the talk. What is universality? Okay, so basically, I mean, if I want to prove universality, what I have to do is that someone is giving me a quantum circuit with L circuits, which are local, and I can assume without loss of generality that there are two local qubits. And they're working over N qubits. And what I have to do is just to decide whether when I act with this circuit on 0 qubits, and then I look at this amplitude, whether this is smaller than 1/3 or it is bigger than 2/3. Okay, it can be shown using standard quantum mechanical techniques that this is basically universality. Okay. So this is the question I have to answer in order to have quantum universality. And how am I going to show that it is possible? What I'm going to do, I'm going to show you a way of how to construct a weighted graph from this circuit, such that the result of this inner product will be equal, more or less, to approximately to the type polynomial of that graph. on some scale.
Okay.
So if we know this graph in this resolution, we will be able to answer this this question. Okay. So this is the idea. This is what we're trying to do here. Okay. How much time do I have?
About 5 minutes, I guess.
Okay. But more.
How much time is there left?
Not much. Okay. Okay. So I'll try to do it quickly. So let me just show you the general idea of how to find this graph. I mean, it's basically the other way around of the algorithm. We start from a quantum circuit, and we will then approximate every circuit as a product of proxying operators. Okay. And we will then obtain a medial graph using from these crossing operators. And from this medial graph, we will simply go to the weight graph, and we will obtain the graph that we are looking for. So this is basically the overall structure of the proof. And the first thing to do is to the first step if we want to do it is to encode every qubit in the circuit as a path. Remember that the crossing operator that we're working with, our building stones, actually work on these Hilbert spaces of patterns. So we must find a way to encode these qubits into patterns, and the way it is done is using the four-step encoding, which was independently found by Kitaev and Washington and Yao. And so we encode the zero qubit as these four steps pass, going to first 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, and one is as this path here. So now if we look at strings of qubits, we will have basically strings of four n passes. Okay. And these four n passes will span a subspace of H4n, which we call L4n. So the relevant subspace for us, a subspace of two qubits, is basically spanned by these four paths. Okay. And of course, any unitary gate is trivially transformed into a unitary operator over these four vectors. Okay, don't be alarmed. So if we now have eight paths, paths with eight steps, then the crossing of, we have exactly seven crossing operators that can work. Okay, because remember that the number of steps is actually the number of strands. So we have eight strands. We have crossing that have eight strands here and eight strands here, and there are exactly seven crossing operators that can work in this configuration. So we have the sigma 1 crossing here, sigma 2 crossing here, etc., etc. So the idea is that to use these operators to approximate any unitary gate on this subspace. And if we use these operators, they take us away from this four-dimensional subspace L8. Okay, so the smallest subspace that we can use is the subspace of all patterns that start at 1 and end at 1. And we call this H8. And this is a 14-dimensional subspace. Okay, we have 14 different ways, 14 different patterns with 8 steps from 1 to 1. And what we will want to do now is to show that using these crossing operators, we can approximate any operator on this subspace. Okay, and I'm still running out of time.
Go on.
Okay. Is it okay, like two more minutes?
Yeah. It's not like there's another talk in the room.
So. Okay. Fine. So the purpose now is basically to show that we can use products of these crossing operators, okay, which translated to matrices under the path of the representation. And using this product, we can approximate any operator. And we will either work on LC14, I mean the unitary operators on this subspace, if we are in the unitary case, or we will work on operators that belong to SL14, Okay, the special linear group, these are operators with which has a determinant equal to 1. Okay, so in the non-unitary case. So what we want to do is to show that these operators, if we take all the products, then they generate basically a dense subgroup in these two groups, in the unitary and in the non-unitary case. And so we have this, this is the group SU14 or SL14. And how do we show that these operators generate a dense subgroup here? The idea is that we start playing with the first two operators, sigma 1 and sigma 2. Okay. So we now look at all the products of the matrices that we get from playing around with these two operators. And we use the first lemma, which is called the seeding lemma. And it tells us when these two things, these two operators generate a dense SU2 or SL2 subgroup. Okay? And this is actually the case where the unitary thing, the unitary case diverges strongly from the non-unitary case. Because in one case we have to prove density in SC2, and in the other case we have to prove density in SL2. And these are completely two different groups. This is a compact group, this is a non-compact group, and as a result the mathematical techniques for proving density here are completely different from the mathematical techniques for proving density here. Here we use, for example, the theory of Möbius transformation and the Yosen inequality, whereas here we use the non-classification of groups in SL3, final group. So it is completely different. And this is actually the place where we have restriction over V and Q, because not all sets of V and Q can give us density. So this is exactly when we know when our problem is BQP-bound. Okay, this dilemma. So in the case where we do have density, then we end up with these blobs, these islands of density, okay, in SU14 or SL14. And the idea next is basically to see what happens when we add the other crossing operator. And then we use the fact that it couples, it mixes some other vectors with some of these SU2 or SL2 dense islands. And we use what we call the bridge lemma that says if we have density here, and we have some connection between them, then basically we have density over all the big thing. So this way, we prove that we have density basically over a bigger chunk of this space. And okay, I will not go into the other details, but basically what we do, we add operators and we build up the dimensionality this way. Okay, using one more lemma. After we proved that these operators are dense, all we have to do in order to prove that they can be that we can construct the graph is that we can find the right product to approximate every operator in an efficient way. This is where we use the Soloveitchi-Thyme theorem. And again, in the non-unitary case, we have to work some more because the Soloveitchi-Thyme theorem works only for the unitary case, so we had to generalize it also for the case of non-unitary groups of SL. And basically, this is how we do it. Again, I'm not trying to go into all these details. So to conclude, we started from these two local gates, and each local gate is now being represented as a product of these crossing operators, and after which we move to this medial graph and we find the what we're looking for. This is it. So to conclude, we found an efficient algorithm to approximate the Tad polynomial for any planar graph and any set of weights and for any Q. And it works in the same approach as the AG algorithm. We map the problem into an algebra, and then we look at the representation of this algebra, which can be directly implemented on a quantum computer. What we did here is to show that we can also work with non-unitary representation, both in the algorithmic and in the universality parts. And we obtain also an approximation for the partition function of the pot model, which was a long-standing problem. But this particular thing brings me to another open question. The universality proof that we showed, the hardness, does not apply for the case of the Boltzmann. So we don't know yet if the approximation that we provide for the case, for the special parameters of the Potts model is trivial or not trivial. Okay, we don't know what's how good this approximation here. So showing that it is universal or it is not universal is still an open question. And what is the quantum complexity of estimating the Potts model is still unknown. Another interesting question is whether these things can be generalized to non-Talon graph. For example, we know that there are algorithms that do similar thing for non-Talon graph given adequate approximation. And this is a recent result. I don't remember the guys who did that. It's a few months ago. But the problem is that they don't. Again, it's an additive approximation, and they don't have any complexity result. So we don't know how good this approximation is. We have no idea. And finally, it would be interesting to see if there are any other combinatorial problems that can be dealt with in this method, and whether this notion of non-unitary universality, what does it mean for quantum? Does it have any physical meaning? Does it have any interesting implications? These are the open questions.
So, I have some questions about the universality result for the non-unitary case.
Yeah.
So, you said that most of the time in the non-unitary case, the two operators, sigma 1, sigma 2, do not generate something that's universal.
Yeah.
So, when that happens, is that, I mean, so then when you go up to lots of operators, whatever, 7 of them, does that mean that those are not universal in SL14?
No, it doesn't mean. It means just I cannot prove. I suspect that it is not, but I didn't prove it.
Okay. And then more generally, I guess I don't quite see it, whether or not it's actually necessary to be universal in SL14 to be BQB hard. I mean, I guess, okay, so one way you could have some further level of encoding, but beyond that...
No, you're right, it is not necessary, because all you want to do is to approximate unitary operators, which are also in SL14, but, you know, they're not spread all over SL14. For example, their norm is bounded by 1, so they're not all over the place. But we wanted to use techniques from group theory, like the Solovey-Kitaev theorem and stuff like that. So we thought it would be natural to work inside a group.
Okay. So anyway, the goal. I mean, assuming you had, you know, more powerful techniques and could prove whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
The goal then would not necessarily be to show density in SL14. It would be able to show that you're arbitrarily close to the unitary subgroup.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, I have something to say or something to ask about the first part, efficiency. So I want to challenge your result, and I want to know what you think about it. So I would say, in the high accuracy limit,
in what limit?
High accuracy limit. So by what do I mean by this? You gave that at the beginning. You gave sort of an accuracy parameter epsilon that was your approximation scale divided by some polynomial factor, I suppose, in the number of repetitions.
Yes.
Okay. Now suppose you want to get this epsilon down to 1. So this is what I mean, high accuracy limit.
Just a second. I mean, what I had. Okay. What I show is up to finite y such that this is more than epsilon times some scale delta x, and epsilon is 1 over poly.
Okay, I see, thanks. So I want this product, epsilon times the scale yeah. equal to 1, this is what I mean with the high accuracy limit.
Actually, what he wanted to is to be the same order of f, or smaller than f.
Yeah.
Because f can be exponentially smaller, then if it is 1, it means nothing.
Yeah, so in a multiplicative approximation, 1 would be order of f. But I want to keep my argument simple at this point.
Yeah.
Maybe can generalize. So, but anyway, if that product is 1, I mean, if you want that accurate an approximation, I would say that this algorithm here is worse than the standard classical algorithm.
Well, not all the time.
Well, and let me give you the argument. So your approximation scale, I mean, of course, I'm talking about the non-unitary case. So you're losing at every edge of your original graph.
Mm-hmm.
So
this losing, it is not exactly, because also in the unitary case, you lose, because whenever you have a minima or a maxima, I mean, it is not unitary.
Anyway, your approximation scale was the, if I remember correctly, was the product of these inverse norm factors associated with
the product of all the norms, yes. Basically.
Okay, so it is. So consider now a simple quadratic lattice, just standard lattice n by n.
Mm-hmm.
So you have two n edges in this lattice. So this approximation window is exponential in n squared.
Yeah.
Okay. And, I suppose...
in n squared?
Yes, in n squared, because you have an n by n lattice.
But it's only one direction if you're... I mean, each time slice is in...
You have a long factor for every edge.
Yeah, roughly for every edge is a crossing, and you have basically it's true.
Yeah. Okay. And so that guy delta is proportional. Well, it's exponential to n squared, and you need to somehow make up for that by an enormous number of repetitions. So would you agree that in order to get this epsilon times delta of order 1? You need operational resources exponential in n squared.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, sort of the.
But can I interfere for a second? I mean, you don't know what f of x is. It can be also exponentially large, and then.
Okay. I mean, therefore I said initially, if you really go for that high accuracy limit, I mean, you might never need that accuracy. I see. But sort of in that limit, and then I mean, now do what you have proposed to do. Quantumly, do it classically. So take your Hilbert space, well, that you had, to embed it in sort of this tensor product, Hilbert space guy. And now what you did quantumly, just do it classically.
But if you do it classically, you cannot, because your Hilbert space is exponentially large.
Exactly.
You can.
But only exponentially in n, right? So the operational resources in that case for the classical algorithm scale exponential in n. Why, for this case...
But you're getting a completely different... You're getting a completely different thing. I mean, if you do it classically, first of all, you will get a multiplicative approximation, not an algebraic approximation, because you will have control. I mean, you will be able to...
But you get it exactly.
Yeah, so... Yeah,
yeah, yeah, okay, so you're even better than that.
But
you need only exponential...
Yeah, but we're talking about polynomials, polynomial thing. And the thing is that you cannot do it polynomially. Also, this... You cannot do it polynomially using classical computer also on this very exponentially large scale unless you're able to simulate a quantum computer. Because this is particularly hard.
Why is it exponentially n? I mean, you still have n squared process, right?
Yeah, okay, but the Hilbert space has dimension q to the n something.
Yeah, but you still have to resolve all the process, right? Which each of which can double the size.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't affect the size of the space.
But the sum. Doesn't specify the space, but it affects the size of the sum, right? You have to add up terms for each of those crossings, right? And each crossing has two terms that you have to add. And you have to resolve those down.
I mean, you do not... you do not... Well, you don't... I mean, that's the way you can do it. But you don't need to do it that way. So you can represent sort of... I mean, just... What he suggested to do with a quantum computer at every sort of constant time slice, represent what you have by a state, and then for each crossing, act on that state by a matrix. So, right?
Yeah, but let's tell you that. I mean, I agree with you.
Yeah, that's it. But it,
that if you want to approximate
n squared times 2 the n, so you're saying.
Yes.
I agree with you that if you want to approximate the tuple of a given graph, mm-hmm. then this algorithm doesn't really work. Because you have no idea whether you're doing a good job or a bad job. What you know is that if you're doing it on a set of graphs, then you're doing a good job. Because approximating on a set of graphs, is BKP hard. So you're doing better than you would do with any polynomial classical algorithm. But when you're looking at a particular graph, then yes. I mean, you don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have given just for an illustration, I have spoken of the square lattice to get this scaling n squared versus n. But I think that was special, and I think you can generalize the argument. I mean, your algorithm is exponential in the number of edges.
No. What do you mean exponential in the number of edges?
But that's really an accuracy thing, right?
The quantum.
There's a limit of high accuracy where this guy is inefficient.
Yeah.
And there must be sort of a changeover where this becomes efficient. And I don't know actually where the point is.
Well,
but
there are some points where this scale is of the order of that scale. There are some points. These are exactly the points where this sandwich product is bigger than something is not exponentially small. This is exactly the point. And you have matrices, unitary matrices.
Yeah, unitary, of course. If you're unitary, you don't have that
problem. But it's the same thing. I mean, remember this unitary matrix we have also in the non-unitary case, using these auxiliary qubits here. It's the same thing.
No, it's not the same.
The non-unitarity does not play that important role.
The composition, the diagonal part is what gives the problem.
No, because...
Well, that is what caused the problem.
No, so you have these loops, which also change the norm. The unitary one doesn't give you an exact answer, right? It gives you an approximate answer.
Yeah, but I mean, the approximation window is much better in the unitary case. Oh, yes.
It is not much better, because if it was much better, then we would not be able to prove universality for the non-unitary case. But we are able to do it. And it means that it's not.
Yes, just something to do with denseness. I mean, it's a totally different question.
Why? But
I mean, if you're unitary, I mean, your approximation window scales totally differently. I think it doesn't scale with the number of edges.
No, it does. Because again, each loop is changing the norm, right? Even in the unitary case.
You're not doing this. I mean, you're not solving the crossings in that way. You're not
but
doing this.
In the unitary case, you don't deal with pure unitary operators. You deal with unitary operators times some factor. So you don't need the ancilla qubits, but you're taking these norm, these factors outside. So it's the same. The ancilla qubits don't really do the problem here. It's this factor of the norm that does the problem.
Yeah, and if you're the unitary case, I mean, you have a problem at the end of course, right? So many strands.
Yeah, you have to close them up.
You measure at the end,
yeah.
And of course your outcome that you want is sort of exponentially rare in the number of strands that you have, right? But that is much less than the number of crosses.
Oh, it depends on the graph.
Well, it depends on the graph, but in general.
Depends. Yeah. I don't know.
For braid
like medial graph, look at long braids, you're right. But
yeah.
Other medial. It also depends on how you dissect it, I mean, how you embed it on the thing.
Yeah. Okay.
But the bottom line is that this approximation is not trivial when you try to do it on a set of graph, because then it's BKP hard. If you're using it for one particular graph, and I would use a quantum algorithm. If I had to use a polynomial algorithm, I would take the quantum algorithm because it is probably better than any classical polynomial algorithm. But it, of course, nobody, no one promises that it will give a meaningful result. But it's the same with the Jones polynomial, it's the same with all these algorithms. This is the problem with additive approximations.
But if you do it, but you know how big the approximation window is, right? So if you do it, you get an answer that's bigger than that approximation window, then you know you've got a meaningful result, right?
Excellent. If you what?
So if you know the size of that window.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you get a result that's, you know, 2 times the size of that window, then you know that you're off by, you know, almost a factor of 2, right? So.
Yeah, but I mean, what you get is you get the numbers. I guess what you say is that if we see if this number alternates its sign, if it already, as we decrease this window, this epsilon, and then we can somehow figure out whether the approximation is meaningful or not. I guess it can be done.
Well, no, I mean, you can't always tell. I mean, if 0 is within your window, then you don't know anything. It could be very small, or it could be
zero. Zero is always in your window.
Really?
Yeah, because delta x is always bigger than delta x, always. Question is whether it is an order of, I mean, if it's the same order of magnitude, then using this epsilon you can make it smaller. So zero will always be initially in the window, but then as you increase the accuracy, when you take epsilon to be smaller, then you can start getting results which are far away from zero, and then you have some sort of
sure.
security that, okay, you're doing the right job.
Right. So of course, all this is just probabilistic.
Yeah.
So you don't have a strict window, but you can say, you know, with very high probability that it's different
yeah.
from zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you start to get something meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
But, you know, it might be that you never get that it's different from zero, which means you don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah, exactly.
Any more questions? Not to thank the speaker.
Thank you.
How long are you visiting for?
Until Thursday.